Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear the first part of a fine talk by Dr. David Ray Griffin, titled, Is the War in Afghanistan Justified by 9/11? Dr. Griffin is Professor of Philosophy of Religion and Theology, Emeritus, at Claremont Graduate University, a Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and one of the leading scholars in the so-called 9/11 Truth Movement. He has published nearly 40 books. The most recent, just out, is The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why the Final Official Report About 9/11 is Unscientific and False. He spoke at the University of Hartford on May 7, 2010. Some of the facts Griffin states are startling. Here are a handful. 2 months before 9/11, Bush approved the invasion of Afghanistan to be begun in October. There is no credible evidence that Osama bin Laden had anything to do with 9/11, and bin Laden himself denied that he did. The identification of the 19 alleged hijackers is highly dubious, and no credible evidence has been made public that the 19 people the government alleges were the hijackers had even boarded any of the flights. This sounds on the fringes of wild conspiracy theories, but Griffin is a careful scholar, and he substantiates every claim with cogent evidence, much of it from U.S. government documents. This is a lucid, well-reasoned, judicious, evidence-based, and bleeping scary talk. Dr. David Ray Griffin.
Okay, my topic is the war in Afghanistan justified by the 9/11 attacks? There are many questions to ask about the war in Afghanistan. One that is being widely asked is whether it will turn out to be Obama's Vietnam. This question implies another, whether this war is winnable or whether it is turning into a quagmire like Vietnam. A question motivated by the widespread agreement that the government of Hamid Karzai is at least as incompetent and corrupt as the government that we tried to prop up in South Vietnam for 20 years. There are many other similarities, but there's also one big difference. This time, there is no draft. If there were a draft so that college students and the friends back home were being sent to Vietnam, there would be Afghanistan. Yeah, it is deja vu. There would be marches and protests on campuses all across this country. If the sons and daughters of middle-class and upper-class parents were coming home in boxes or with permanent injuries or with post-traumatic stress syndrome leading many of them to suicide, this war would have been stopped long ago. It's often asked, did we learn any of the lessons of Vietnam? Yes, our government learned one. If you're going to have an unpopular war, don't have a draft. Hire mercenaries. The number of contractors in Afghanistan far outnumber the troops. Well, there are many other questions, such as, why are we spending tens and hundreds of billions of dollars in that country when our own country is in such dire circumstances? But I'm going to focus only on one question tonight. Is this war justified? There are two parts. Is it legally justified? Is it morally justified? Since the founding of the United Nations in 1945, international law with regard to war has been defined by the UN Charter. Measured by this standard, the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan is illegal. Marjorie Cohn, a well-known professor of international law, wrote in November 2001, "The bombings of Afghanistan by the United States and the United Kingdom are illegal." In 2008, Cohn repeated this argument in an article entitled "Afghanistan, the Other Illegal War." Her argument was based on the following points. First, according to international law, as codified in the UN Charter, disputes are to be brought before the UN Security Council, which alone may authorize the use of force. Without this authorization, any military activity against another nation is illegal. Second, there are two exceptions. One is that if your nation has been subjected to an armed attack by another nation, you may respond militarily in self-defense. This condition was not fulfilled by the 9/11 attacks because they were not carried out by another nation. Afghanistan did not attack the United States. Indeed, the 19 men charged with the attacks were not Afghanis. The other exception occurs when one nation has certain knowledge that an attack by another nation or group is imminent. Too imminent to bring the matter to the Security Council. The need for self-defense must be, in the generally accepted phrase, instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means and no moment for deliberation. Although the U.S. government claimed that its military operations in Afghanistan were justified by the need to prevent a second attack, this need, even if real, clearly was not urgent, as shown by the fact that the military waited almost a month to launch its invasion. U.S. political leaders have claimed to be sure that the U.N. did authorize the U.S. attack on Afghanistan. This claim, originally made by the Bush-Cheney administration, was repeated by President Obama in his West Point speech of December 1, 2009, in which he said, "The United Nations Security Council endorsed the use of all necessary steps to respond to the 9/11 attacks. So U.S. troops went to Afghanistan under the banner of international legitimacy." However, the language of all necessary steps is from a UN Security Council Resolution 1368, in which the Council, taking note of its own responsibilities under the Charter, expressed its own readiness to take all necessary steps to respond to the terrorist attacks of 11 September. Of course, the UN Security Council might have determined that one of those necessary steps was to authorize an attack on Afghanistan by the United States. But it did not. Resolution 1373, the only other Security Council resolution to deal with this issue, laid out various responses, but they included matters such as freezing assets, criminalizing the support of terrorists, and prosecuting terrorists. The use of military force was not mentioned. U.S. war in Afghanistan was not authorized in 2001, and it has never been authorized since. So this war began as an illegal war, and it remains an illegal war today. Our government's claim to the contrary is false. This war is illegal, moreover, not only under international law, but also under U.S. law. The U.N. Charter is a treaty which was ratified by the United States, and according to Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, any treaty ratified by the United States is part of the supreme law of the land. The war in Afghanistan is therefore in violation of U.S. as well as international law. This war could not be more illegal. The American public, for the most part, is probably unaware of the illegality of this war because this is not something our political leaders or corporate media have been anxious to publicize. So most people simply don't know. If they were informed, however, many Americans would be inclined to argue that, even if technically illegal, the U.S. military effort in Afghanistan is justified by the 9/11 attacks. For a summary statement of this argument, we can turn again to the West Point speech of President Obama, who has taken over the Bush-Cheney account of 9/11. Answering the question of why America and our allies were compelled to fight a war in Afghanistan in the first place, Obama said, "We did not ask for this fight. On September 11, 2001, 19 men hijacked four airplanes and used them to murder nearly 3,000 people. They struck at our military and economic nerve centers. They took the lives of innocent men, women, and children without regard to their faith or race or station. As we know, these men belong to Al-Qaeda, a group of extremists who have distorted and defiled Islam. After the Taliban refused to turn over Osama bin Laden, we sent our troops into Afghanistan." This standard account can be summarized in terms of 3 points. First, the attacks were carried out by 19 Muslim members of Al-Qaeda. Second, the attacks had been authorized by the founder of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, who was in Afghanistan. Third, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan was necessary because the Taliban, which was in control of Afghanistan, refused to turn over bin Laden to U.S. authorities. On the basis of these three points, our political leaders have claimed that the United States has the moral right, arising from the universal right of self-defense, to attempt to capture or kill bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network to prevent them from launching another attack on our country. The only problem with this argument is that all three points are false. I will show this by looking at these points in reverse order. The claim that the Taliban refused to turn over bin Laden has been repeatedly made by our political leaders and our mainstream media. Reports from the time, however, show the truth to be very different. 10 days after the 9/11 attacks, CNN reported, "The Taliban refused to hand over bin Laden without proof or evidence that he was involved in last week's attacks on the United States." The Taliban ambassador to Pakistan said Friday that deporting him without proof would be an insult to Islam. CNN also made clear that the Taliban's demand for proof was not made without reason, saying, "Bin Laden himself has already denied that he had anything to do with the attacks, and Taliban officials repeatedly said he could not have been involved in the attacks." Bush, however, said the demands were not open to negotiation or discussion. With this refusal to provide evidence of bin Laden's responsibility, the Bush administration made it impossible for the Taliban to turn over bin Laden. As Afghan experts quoted by the Washington Post pointed out, "The Taliban, in order to turn over bin Laden to an infidel Western nation, needed a face-saving formula." Milton Bearden, who had been the CIA station chief in Afghanistan in the 1980s, put it this way: "While the United States was demanding, 'Give up bin Laden,' the Taliban were saying, 'Do something to help us give him up.' But the United States refused." After the bombing began in October, the Taliban tried again, offering to turn over bin Laden to a third country if the United States would simply stop the bombing and provide evidence of his guilt. But Bush replied, "There's no need to discuss innocence or guilt. We know he's guilty." An article in London's Guardian, which reported this development, was entitled, "Bush Rejects Taliban Offer to Hand bin Laden Over." So it was the Bush administration, not the Taliban, that was responsible for the fact that bin Laden was not handed over. In August of 2009, President Obama, who had criticized the U.S. invasion of Iraq as a war of choice, said of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, "This is not a war of choice. This is a war of necessity." The evidence shows, however, that this was also a war of choice. This conclusion is reinforced by reports indicating that the United States had made the decision to attack Afghanistan 2 months before the 9/11 attacks. The background to this decision was the United States' long-time support for a pipeline project proposed by UNICAL, which would transport oil and gas from the Caspian Sea region to the Indian Ocean down through Afghanistan and Pakistan. This project had been stymied through the 1990s because of the civil war that had been raging in Afghanistan since the withdrawal of the Soviet Union in 1989. In the mid-1990s, the U.S. government had supported the Taliban with the hope that its military strength would enable it to unify the country and provide a stable government that could protect the pipeline. By the late 1990s, however, the Clinton administration had given up on the Taliban. When the Bush administration came to power, it decided to give the Taliban one last chance. During a 4-day meeting in Berlin in 2001, July of that year, representatives of the Bush administration insisted that the Taliban must create a government of national unity by bringing in factions and sharing power with factions friendly to the United States. The U.S. representatives reportedly said, "Either you accept our offer of a carpet of gold, or we will bury you under a carpet of bombs." After the Taliban refused this offer, the Americans repeatedly said, "Military action against Afghanistan would go ahead before the snows started in Afghanistan by the middle of October at the latest. And indeed, given the fact that the 9/11 attacks occurred on 9/11, the U.S. military was ready to launch its invasion on October 7. It appears, therefore, that the United States invaded Afghanistan for reasons far different from the official rationale according to which we were there to capture or kill Osama bin Laden. I turn now to the second point, the claim that Osama bin Laden had authorized the attacks. Even if the Bush administration had refused to give the Taliban evidence of bin Laden's guilt, surely most Americans probably believe it had this evidence and shared it with people who needed to know. However, again, the evidence from the time shows otherwise. 2 weeks after 9/11, Secretary of State Colin Powell said that he expected in the near future to put out a document that will describe quite clearly the evidence that we have linking bin Laden to this attack. But at a joint press conference the very next morning with President Bush, Powell had to withdraw this pledge, saying that most of the evidence is classified. Seymour Hersh, citing officials from both the CIA and the Department of Justice, said the real reason why Powell withdrew the pledge was a lack of solid information. The following week, British Prime Minister Tony Blair issued a document to show that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, the terrorist network which he heads, planned and carried out the atrocities on 11 September 2001. Blair's report began, however, by saying, "This document does not purport to provide a prosecutable case against Osama bin Laden in a court of law." So the evidence was good enough to go to war, but not good enough to go to court. The next day, the BBC emphasized this weakness, saying, "There is no direct evidence in the public domain linking Osama bin Laden to the 11 September attacks." What about our FBI? Its most wanted terrorist webpage on Osama bin Laden does not list 9/11 as one of the terrorist acts for which he is wanted. When asked why not, the FBI's chief of investigative publicity replied, "Because the FBI has no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. What about the 9/11 Commission? Its entire report is based on the assumption that bin Laden was behind the attacks. However, the report's evidence to support this premise has been disowned by the Commission's own co-chairs, Thomas Kane and Lee Hamilton. This evidence consisted of testimony that had reportedly been extracted by the CIA from Al-Qaeda operatives. The most important of these operatives was colleague Sheikh Mohammed, normally called simply KSM, and he has been called the mastermind of 9/11, and he, of course, is the one that they're having so much trouble finding a venue to try him. If you read the 9/11 Commission's account of how bin Laden planned the attacks, and then check those tiny notes in the back of the book, you will see that almost every bit of evidence says it came from KSM. In 2006, Kane and Hamilton wrote a book giving the inside story of the 9/11 Commission, in which they call this information untrustworthy. They had no success, they reported, in obtaining access to star witnesses in custody, most notably colleague Sheikh Mohammed. Besides not being allowed by the CIA to interrogate him, they were not allowed to watch the interrogation through a one-way glass. They were not even allowed to interview the interrogators. As a consequence, Kane and Hamilton complained, "We had no way of evaluating the credibility of detainee information. How could we tell if someone such as colleague Sheikh Mohammed was telling the truth?" Accordingly, neither the Bush administration, the British government, the FBI, nor the 9/11 Commission ever provided reliable evidence of bin Laden's responsibility for the 9/11 attacks. Some people argue, to be sure, that such evidence is no longer necessary because bin Laden admitted his responsibility in a videotape that was discovered in Jalalabad in November 2001 by the U.S. military. But bin Laden had previously denied his involvement many times. And bin Laden experts have called this video a fake, and for good reasons. Many of the physical features of the man on this video are different from those of Osama bin Laden. And he said many things that Osama bin Laden himself would not have said. I can't develop that here, but I have spelled it out in a little tiny book called Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive. In any case, the FBI evidently does not believe that that so-called confession video provides hard evidence of bin Laden's responsibility, or it would have revised its webpage. So, to review the first 2 points, the Taliban said it would turn over bin Laden if our government had given it good evidence of his guilt, but we refused, and good evidence of this responsibility has never been provided to the public. I turn now to the third claim, that even if there is no proof that Osama bin Laden authorized the attacks, we have abundant evidence that the attacks were carried out by Muslims belonging to his al-Qaeda network. This is still widely assumed. The truth, however, is that the evidence in favor of al-Qaeda hijackers falls apart upon examination. And this suggests that 9/11 was instead a false flag operation, an attack that people within our own government orchestrated while planning evidence to implicate Muslims. Let us begin with the 9/11 Commission's claim that the men who took over the planes were devout Muslims, ready to sacrifice their lives for the cause. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that Muhammad Atta, the so-called ringleader of the hijackers, and some other hijackers had made at least 6 trips to Las Vegas, where they had engaged in some decidedly un-Islamic sampling of prohibited pleasures. Somebody at that paper can write. The Chronicle then quoted the head of the Islamic Foundation of Nevada as saying, "True Muslims don't drink, don't gamble, don't go to strip clubs." The contradiction is especially strong with regard to Muhammad Atta himself. On the one hand, according to the 9/11 Commission, he had become very religious, even fanatically so. This characterization was supported by Professor Dittmar McCooley, who was Atta's thesis advisor at a technical university in Hamburg, Germany in the 1990s. McCooley said that this student was very religious, prayed regularly, and never touched alcohol. According to the American press, on the other hand, Muhammad Atta drank heavily, and one night after downing 5 glasses of vodka, shouted an Arabic word that, Newsweek magazine said, roughly translates as, and now I need John Stewart's bleep machine, F, blank, blank, K, God. Investigative reporter Daniel Hopsicker, who wrote a book about Atta, stated that Atta regularly went to strip clubs, hired prostitutes, drank heavily, and took cocaine. Atta even lived with a stripper for several months, and then, after she kicked him out, came back and disemboweled her cat and her kittens and left them on the kitchen floor. Could this be the same individual as Professor McCooley's student, who would not even shake hands with a woman upon being introduced to her, and who never touched alcohol? Could the Atta described by Hopsicker and the American press be the young man whom this professor described as not a bodyguard type, but more a girl-looking type? Could the man who disemboweled kittens be the young man known to his father and mother as a gentle and tender boy whom they called Nightingale? We are clearly talking about 2 different men. This is confirmed by the differences in their appearance. The American Atta was described as having a hard and cruel face, and this is borne out by the standard FBI photo. The face of the Hamburg student was quite different, as photos available on the Internet show. Also, his professor described him as very small, under 5'4", whereas the American Atta has been described as 5'8", and even 5'10". One final reason to believe that these different descriptions apply to 2 different men. The father of Muhammad al-Amir Atta reported that on September 12th, before he had learned about the attacks, He was called by his son, who also had not learned of the attacks, and so they just talked about this and that. There are also problems in relation to many of the other alleged hijackers. For example, the BBC reported that Walid al-Sheri, who supposedly died with Atta on American Flight 11 and was said by the 9/11 Commission to have stabbed one of the flight attendants, spoke to journalists and American authorities in Casablanca 1 week after 9/11. Moreover, there were clearly two men going by the name of Ziad Jarar, the name of the alleged hijacker pilot of United Flight 93. Accordingly, besides the fact that the men labeled the hijackers were not devout Muslims, they may not have been Muslims of any sort. And if that were not bad enough for the official story, there is no good evidence that these men were even on the planes. All the evidence for this claim falls apart upon examination. Now, I can only give a couple examples in the book that shall mention the new Pearl Harbor Revisited. I give many examples. I deal with every bit of evidence that has been given to convince us that these men were on the plane. And I show that they all fall apart, some of them ludicrously so. One of the purported proofs that the 19 men identified as the hijackers were on the planes was the reported discovery of some of their passports at crash sites. But the reports of these discoveries are not believable. For example, the FBI claimed that while searching the streets after the destruction of the World Trade Center, they discovered the passport of Saddam al-Sukami, one of the hijackers on American Flight 11, which had crashed into the North Tower. But for this to be true, the passport would have had to survive the destruction of the North Tower, which for some reason pulverized everything into tiny particles of dust except the steel and al-Sukami's passport. This claim, as you've illustrated, was too absurd to pass the giggle test. By 2004, it was modified to say that a passerby picked it up and gave it to a New York police detective shortly before the World Trade Center towers collapsed. So rather than needing to survive the collapse of the North Tower, the passport merely needed to escape from al-Sukami's pocket or his luggage, and then from the cabin of the plane, and then from the building without being burned up or even singed by that giant fireball that exploded immediately and fell to the ground. This version was no less ludicrous than the first one. And the other stories about passports at crash sites are equally absurd.
Ask yourself, have I been listening to a wild-eyed kook, or instead a meticulous and judicious scholar? Thanks for listening to New World Notes, illegitimae non carborundum, and hope to see you again next week.